The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 4, Side 1. Céline ate from the same pot as the Baptists, shared his bread and warm victuals with them. Of course, he needed appreciative listeners, people with whom he could join in reading and interpreting the gospel, and in concealing the little book itself. But Orthodox Christians he either did not seek out, suspecting that they would reject him as a heretic, or did not find. There were few of them in our camp except for the Western Ukrainians, or else they were no more consistent in their conduct than others, and so inconspicuous. The Baptists, however, seemed to respect Céline, listened to him. They even considered him one of their own. But they, too, disliked all that was heretical in him, and hoped in time to bend him to their ways. Céline was subdued when he talked to me in their presence, and blossomed out when they were not there. It was difficult for him to force himself into their mould, though their faith was firm, pure, and ardent, helping them to endure katorga without wavering and without spiritual collapse. They were all honest, free from anger, hard-working, quick to help others, devoted to Christ. That is why they are being rooted out with such determination. In the years 1948 to 1950, several hundred of them were sentenced to 25 years imprisonment and dispatched to special camps for no other reason than that they belonged to Baptist communes. A commune is, of course, an organization. The persecution became less severe in the Khrushchev period, only in that shorter sentences were given. Otherwise, it was just as bad. See Part 7. The camp is different from the great outside. Outside, everyone uninhibitedly tries to express and emphasize his personality in his outward behavior. In prison, on the contrary, all are depersonalized, identical haircuts, identical fuzz on their cheeks, identical caps, identical padded jackets. The face presents an image of the soul distorted by wind and sun and dirt and heavy toil. Discerning the light of the soul beneath this depersonalized and degraded exterior is an acquired skill. But the sparks of the spirit cannot be kept from spreading, breaking through to each other. Like recognizes and is gathered to like in a manner none can explain. You can understand a man better and more quickly if you know at least a fragment of his biography. Here are some trench diggers working side by side. Thick, soft snow has begun to fall. Perhaps because it is time for a break, the whole team goes into the dugout for shelter. But one man remains standing outside. At the edge of the trench, he leans on his spade and stands quite motionless, as though he found it comfortable, or as though he were a statue. The snowflakes gathering on his head, shoulders and arms make him still more like a statue. Doesn't he care? Does he even like it? He stares through the flurry of snowflakes at the camp, at the white step. He has broad bones, broad shoulders, a broad face, with a growth of stiff blonde bristles. He is always deliberate, slow-moving, very calm. He remains standing there, looking at the world and thinking. He is elsewhere. I do not know him, but his friend Redkin tells me his story. This man is a Tolstoyan. He grew up with the antiquated notion that a man may not kill, even in the name of the vanguard doctrine, and must not therefore take up arms. In 1941 he was called up. Near Kushka, to which he had been posted, he threw his gun away and crossed the Afghan border. There were no Germans around Kushka, and none were expected, so that he could have had a quiet war, never shooting at a living thing, but even lugging that piece of iron around on his back went against his convictions. He supposed that the Afghans would respect his right not to kill people and let him go through to India, where there was religious tolerance. But the Afghan government turned out to be as cynically self-interested as governments always are. Fearing the wrath of its all-powerful neighbor, it put the runaway in the stocks, and kept him in prison, with his legs cramped in the stocks, unable to move, for 3 years, waiting to see which side would win. The Soviets did, and the Afghans obligingly returned the deserter to them. His present sentence was reckoned only from that date. Now he stood motionless out in the snow, like part of the landscape. Had he been brought into the world by the state? Why, then, had the state usurped the right to decide how this man should live? We don't mind having a fellow countryman called Lev Tolstoy. It's a good trademark. Even makes a good postage stamp. Foreigners can be taken on trips to Yasnaya Polyana. We are always ready to drool over his opposition to Tsarism and his excommunication. The announcer's voice will tremble at this point. But, my dear countrymen, if someone takes Tolstoy seriously, if a real live Tolstoyan springs up among us, hey, look out there. Mind you don't fall under our caterpillar tracks. Perhaps on the building site you run and ask the foreman, a prisoner, for his folding rule to measure how much wall you've laid. He sets great store by this ruler and doesn't know you by sight. There are so many teams on the job. But for some reason he hands you his treasure without demur, sheer stupidity to the camp-trained mind. And when you actually return the ruler to him, he will thank you very warmly. How can such a weird character be a foreman in a camp? He has an accent. Ah, yes, he turns out to be a Pole. His name is Jerzy Wegiewski. You will hear more of him. Perhaps you're marching along in the columns and you ought to be telling your beads inside your mitten or thinking about your next stanzas, but you'll find yourself very much interested by your neighbour in the ranks, a new face. They have just sent a new brigade to your work site. An elderly, likable Jewish intellectual with a mocking, intelligent expression. His name is Masamed, and he is a university graduate from Bucharest. Faculty of Biology and Psychology. He is, among other things, a physiognomist and graphologist. Moreover, he is a yogi and will start you on a course in Hatha Yoga tomorrow. That's the pity of it. Our term in this university is so short, I can never get my breath. There's no time to take it all in. Later on, I took a good look at him in the work zone and the living area. His fellow countrymen had offered to fix him up with an office job, but he wouldn't take it. It was important to him to show that Jews, too, make excellent general labourers. So at the age of 50, he fearlessly wields his pickaxe. Like a true yogi, he really is master of his own body. At -10°C, he strips and asks his workmates to hose him down from the fire hydrant. Unlike the rest of us who shovel that wretched gruel into our mouths as fast as we can, he eats slowly, with concentration, looking away from his plate, swallowing a little at a time from a tiny spoon of his own. Nonetheless, he was to die soon, like an ordinary mortal, of an ordinary heart attack. It does happen, and not so very rarely, that you make an interesting new acquaintance on the way to or from work. But you can't always get going in the column, with the guards shouting and your neighbours hissing, "Because of you, us as well." On the way to work, you're too sluggish, and on the way back, in too much of a hurry, and very likely there's a wind to shut your gob. Yet suddenly, well, of course, these are untypical cases, as the socialist realists say, quite exceptional cases. In the outermost line walks a little man with a thick black beard. Because he had it when he was last arrested and was photographed with it, it has not been shaved off in the camp. He walks very briskly, very much on his dignity, carrying a carefully tied roll of draftsman's paper under his arm. This is a rationalization proposal, or invention of his, some new thing of which he is proud. He drew it at work, brought it to show to somebody in the camp, and is now taking it with him back to work. Suddenly, a mischievous wind plucks the roll from under his arm and bowls it along away from the column. Arnold Rappaport, the reader already knows him, instinctively takes a step in pursuit of it, a second, a third, but the roll drifts on farther between two guards, beyond the escort. This is where Rappaport should stop. One step to right or left, remember, and you get it without warning. "But that's mine, my drawing, it's over there." And Arnold trots after it, bending forward, arms extended, and evil fate is carrying off his idea. Arnold reaches out eagerly. His hands rake the air. "Barbarian, don't touch my blueprints." The column sees him, stumbles to a halt of its own accord. Guns are pointed, bolts click back. Everything so far was typical, but now came something untypical. No one acted like a fool. No one fired. The barbarians realized that this was not an escape. Even to their befuddled brains, this was an immediately comprehensible scene, the author pursuing his fleeing creation. Rappaport ran on another 15 paces or so beyond the escort guards, caught his role, straightened up, and returned to the ranks, very pleased with himself. Returned from the next world. Although Rappaport had landed more than the average camp stint, after a kid's sentence and a tenner had come banishment, and now he was doing another tenner, he was full of life, agile, bright-eyed, and those eyes of his, although they were always merry, were made for suffering, were very expressive eyes. It was a matter of pride to him that years of prison had not aged and broken him. As an engineer, he had, however, always worked as a trustee on some production job, so that it was easy for him to keep his spirits up. He took a lively interest in his work, but over and beyond it he created for his soul's sake. He was one of those versatile characters, eager to embrace everything. At one time he was thinking of writing a book like this of mine, all about the camps, but he never got around to it. Another of his works made us, his friends, laugh. Arnold had for some years been patiently compiling a universal technical reference book, which would cover all the ramifications of modern science and technology, everything from types of radio valves to the average weight of elephants, and which was to be pocket size. The wiser for this laughter, Arnold showed me another of his favourite works in secret, finding Stendhal's treatise on love completely unsatisfactory. He had written a new one in a glossy black exercise book. It consisted of unpolished and, for the present, disconnected remarks. For a man who had spent half his life in the camps, how chaste it all was. Here are some brief extracts. This was all many years ago. Rappaport later abandoned his treatise, and I have his permission to quote it. To possess a woman without love is the unhappy lot of the poor in body and spirit. Yet men boast of it as a conquest. Possession without the preliminary organic development of feeling brings not joy, but shame and revulsion. The men of our age who devote all their energy to making money, to their jobs, to the exercise of power, have lost the gene of higher love. On the other hand, woman's unerring instinct tells her that possession is only the first stage toward genuine intimacy. Only after it does a woman acknowledge a man as near and dear, and show it in her way of speaking to him. Even a woman who gives herself unintentionally feels an access of grateful tenderness. Jealousy is injured self-esteem. Real love, unrequited, is not jealous, but dies, ossifies. Love, as much as science, art, and religion, is a mode of cognition. Combining as he did such very different interests, Arnold Lvovich naturally knew the most various people. He introduced me to a man whom I should have passed by without noticing. At first sight he was just another of the walking dead, doomed to die of malnutrition, with collarbones sticking out from his unbuttoned camp jacket like those of a corpse. His lankiness made him even more astonishingly thin. He was naturally swarthy, and his shaven head had become still darker in the Kazakh sun. He still dragged himself out of the camp to work, still clung to his barrow to stay on his feet. He was a Greek, and once more a poet, yet another. A volume of his verse in modern Greek had been published in Athens, but since he was not an Athenian but a Soviet prisoner and a Soviet citizen, our newspapers shed no tears for him. He was only middle-aged, although so close to death. I made pitifully clumsy attempts to wave these thoughts away. He laughed wisely and explained to me in imperfect Russian that not death itself, but only the moral preparation for it, holds terrors. He had finished with fear and grief and regret, shed all his tears, already lived through his inevitable death, and was quite ready. It only remained for his body to finish dying. So many people turn out to be poets, it's almost unbelievable. Sometimes I was at a loss to understand it. While the Greek waits to die, here are two young men waiting only for the end of their sentence and for future literary fame. They are poets, openly, without concealment. What they have in common is a certain radiant purity. Both are students who never graduated. Kolya Borovikov, an admirer of Pisarev, and therefore an enemy of Pushkin, works as a clinical orderly in the medical section. Yurochka Kireyev from Tver, who admires Bloch and himself writes in the manner of Bloch, goes out of camp to work in the office of the engineering shop. His friends, and what strange friends they are for him, 20 years older and fathers of families, tease him about the time in a corrective labor camp up north, when some generally available Romanian woman offered herself to him, but he didn't understand and wrote sonnets to her. If you look at his innocent face, you can very easily believe it. Now his virginity is a curse and a burden to be carried all through the camps. Sometimes people catch your eye, sometimes you catch theirs. In the big, chaotic barracks where 400 men live, moving restlessly around or lying on their bunks, I read after supper, and during the tedious inspections, the second volume of Dahl's Dictionary, the only book which I had brought as far as Ekibastuds, where I was forced to see it defaced with a stamp saying, Step lag, culture and education section. I never flipped through the pages because in the fag end of the evening I could hardly read through half a page. So I sat or shuffled along for the inspection engrossed in one particular passage. I was used to newcomers asking what that fat book was and wondering why the devil I wanted to read it. I used to answer with a joke. It's the safest thing to read. No danger of catching a new sentence. But that book brought me a lot of interesting acquaintances, too. For instance, a small man, like a bantam cock, with a fierce nose and a sharp, mocking look, comes up to me and says in a sing-song northern accent, May I inquire what book you have there? We exchange a few words, and then as Sunday follows Sunday, as month follows month. In this one man, a microcosm in which half a century of my country's history is densely packed, opens out before me. Vasily Grigorievich Vlasov, the one who was in the Kadi trial and has now got through 14 long years of his 20, thinks of himself as an economist and politician and has no idea that he is an artist in words, in the spoken word. Whether he tells me about haymaking or merchants' shops, he had worked in one as a boy, a Red Army unit or an old country house, an executioner from the provincial deserter interception organization, or an insatiable woman in some small town. I see it all in the round and absorb it as thoroughly as if it had been part of my own experience. I wanted to write it all down at once, but it couldn't be done. I wish I could remember it word for word 10 years later, but it is impossible. I noticed that one man often stole glances at me in my book, but hesitated to start a conversation. A thin, fine-drawn, long-nosed young man whose politeness, diffidence even, seemed strange in those surroundings. I got to know him, too. He spoke in a quiet, shy voice, groping for words in Russian, and making hilarious mistakes, which he immediately redeemed with a smile. It emerged that he was Hungarian, and his name was Janos Rozas. He nodded when I showed him Dahl's dictionary with my eyes on his shriveled, camp-worn face. Yes, yes, he said. A man must distract his attention to other things, not think about food all the time. He was only 25, but there was no youthful flush in his cheeks. The dry, papery skin, made transparent by the winds, seemed to be stretched over the long, narrow bones of his skull, with no flesh between. His joints ached. He had caught rheumatic fever, felling trees in the north. There were two or three of his compatriots in the camp, but all day and every day they were obsessed with one thought only, how to survive and how to eat their fill. Whereas Janos ate whatever the foreman obtained for him, and even though he remained hungry, he made it a rule not to look for more. He was all eyes and ears. He wanted to understand. Understand what, you ask? Us. He wanted to understand us Russians. My personal fate became very uninteresting when I got to know people here. I am most extremely surprised. They loved their own people, and for that they get katorga. But I think this is wartime muddle, yes? He asks this in 1951. If it was still a wartime muddle then, maybe it dated from the First World War. In 1944, when our troops captured him in Hungary, he was 18, and not in the army. I had still had no time to do people either good or evil, he said with a smile. People had seen neither profit nor harm from me. Janos's interrogation went like this. The interrogator didn't understand a word of Hungarian, nor Janos a word of Russian. Occasionally some very bad interpreters came along, Carpathian Ukrainians. Janos signed a 16-page statement, with no idea what was in it. Nor, when an unknown officer read him something from a piece of paper, did he realize that this was the special board's sentence. It is said that when Janos was rehabilitated after Stalin's death, curiosity prompted him to ask for a copy of the sentence in Hungarian, so that he could find out just why he had spent 9 years in prison. But he was afraid to do so. They may wonder what I want to do with it. And anyway, I don't really need it all that much. He had understood our way of thinking. Why, indeed, did he need to know now? They sent him to the north to fell trees, and there he went under and landed in the hospital. Till then, Russia had shown him only one side of herself, the part used for sitting on, but now she turned the other. In the camp hospital at the Simsk separate campsite near Solikamsk, there was a 45-year-old nurse called Dusya. She was a non-political offender, not a part of the professional underworld, was in for 5 years, and had a pass. Her job, as she saw it, was not just to grab all she could and get through her sentence, a very common assumption in the camps, though Janos, with his rosy view of things, did not know it, but to look after these useless, dying people. What the hospital gave was not enough to save them, so Dusya used to exchange her morning ration of 300 grams for half a litre of milk in the village, and with this milk she nursed Janos back to life, as she had nursed others before him. Can someone explain to me what ideology this behaviour fits into? Compare the communist medical orderly in Dyakov. Toothache, eh, you pig-faced Ukrainian bandit? For this motherly woman's sake, Janos came to love Russia and all Russians. He started diligently learning, there in the camp, the language of his warders and convoy guards, the great, the mighty Russian language. He spent 9 years in our camps and saw nothing of Russia except from prison trains on little picture postcards and in the camp. Yet he loved it. Janos belonged to a breed which is steadily becoming rarer in our time, those whose only passion in childhood is reading. He kept this inclination as an adult, and even in the camps. In the north, and in the Ekibastut special camp, he missed no opportunity to obtain and read new books. By the time I met him, he already knew and loved Pushkin, Nekrasov, and Gogol. I explained Griboyedov to him, but more than anyone else, more perhaps than even Petofi and Arani. He came to love Lermontov, whom he had first read in captivity not long before. I have been told more than once by foreigners that Lermontov is dearer to them than any other Russian poet. After all, I point out, Pushkin did write, "To Russia's slanderers," whereas Lermontov never did Tsarism the smallest service. Janos identified himself particularly with Mtsiri, like himself a prisoner, young and doomed. He had much of it by heart, and for years on end, as he dragged himself along with his hands behind his back, in a column of foreigners through an alien land, he would murmur to himself in the stranger's tongue, "I knew then in my troubled mind, my eager foot would no more find the native land I'd left behind." Friendly, affectionate, with vulnerable pale blue eyes, that was Janos Rotsas in our heartless camp. He would perch on my bunk, lightly on the very edge, as though my sack of sawdust could be made any dirtier or would lose its shape under his weight, and say in a low voice full of genuine feeling, "With whom should I share my secret dreams?" He never complained about anything. All the Hungarians were allowed to go home after Stalin's death, so Janos escaped the fate of Mtsiri, for which he was fully prepared. 12 years have passed, 1956 among them. Janos is a bookkeeper in the little town of Nojkanitsa, where nobody knows Russian or reads Russian books. And what does he now write to me? After all that has happened, I can sincerely say that I would not give back my past. I learned in a harsh school what others can never know. When I was freed, I promised the comrades who stayed behind that I would never forget the Russian people, not for their sufferings, but for their good hearts. Why do I follow newspaper reports about my former motherland with such interest? The works of the Russian classics are a whole shelf in my library. I have 41 volumes in Russian and 4 in Ukrainian, Shevchenko. Other people read the Russians as they read the English or the Germans, but I read them differently. To me, Tolstoy is closer than Thomas Mann, and Lermontov much closer than Goethe. You cannot guess how much I miss Russia without talking about it. Sometimes people ask me what kind of crank I am. What good did the place ever do me? Why do I feel drawn to Russians? How can I explain that all my youth went by there, and that life is an eternal farewell from the swiftly passing days? How could I turn my back like a sulky child? For 9 years my fate coincided with yours. How can I explain why my heart misses a beat when I hear a Russian folk song on the radio? I start singing to myself under my breath. See the reckless troika speeding. But it is too painful for me to go on. My children ask me to teach them Russian. Wait a while, children. For whom do you think I collect Russian books? You move among the camp population as you would through a minefield, photographing each of them with the rays of intuition for fear of blowing yourself up. Yet in spite of this general rule of caution, how often I discovered a poetic personality under a Zex-shaven skull and black jacket. How many others kept their secret to themselves? How many more, surely 1,000 times as many, did not come my way at all? And how many in those decades did you smother, infamous Leviathan? Ekibastuts also had an official, though very dangerous, Center for Cultural Intercourse, the Culture and Education section where they stamped black words on books and freshened up our numbers. An important and very colourful figure in our CES was Vladimir Rutschuk, now an artist, but formerly an archdeacon and possibly even personal secretary to the patriarch. There is somewhere in the camp rules an unexpunged proviso that persons in holy orders shall not be shorn. Of course, this rule is never made public, and priests who do not know of it are shorn. But Rutschuk knew his rights, and he was left with wavy auburn locks, unusually long for a man. He took great care of them, and of his appearance generally. He was tall, well-made, attractive, with a pleasant bass voice, and it was easy to imagine him conducting a solemn service in a huge cathedral. Drozdov, the church warden who arrived at Ekibastuts with me, recognized the archdeacon at once. He had formerly served in the cathedral church at Odessa. Here in the camp he neither looked nor lived like a man of our convict world. He was one of those dubious personages who had insinuated themselves, or been insinuated, into the Orthodox Church as soon as they were no longer in official disfavor. They did much to bring the church into disrepute. The story of how Rutschuk came to be in jail was also rather mysterious. For some reason he kept exhibiting a photograph, inexplicably left in his possession, of himself with Anastasi, the metropolitan of the Russian Orthodox Church in exile on a New York street. He had a cabin to himself in the camp. When he got back from work line-up, where he disdainfully painted the numbers on our caps, jackets, and trousers, he would spend the day in idleness, occasionally making crude copies of tasteless pictures. He was allowed to keep a volume of reproductions from the Tretyakov Gallery, and it was because of these that I found my way to him. I wanted to take another look, perhaps my last. He had the Bulletin of the Moscow Patriarchate sent to him in the camp, and sometimes discoursed pompously on the great martyrs or on details of the liturgy, but it was all affectation, all insincere. He also had a guitar, and the only thing he ever did sincerely was to sing, in a pleasant voice, to his own accompaniment. Even then his writhing was intended to suggest that he was haloed with a convict's crown of sorrow. The better a man lives in the camp, the more exquisite his suffering. I was cautious to the nth degree in those days. I never called on Rudchuk again. I told him nothing about myself, and as a harmless, insignificant worm escaped his sharp eye. Rudchuk's eye was the eye of the MGB. Anyway, every old hand in the camp knew that any CES was riddled with informers, and the least suitable place imaginable to seek new acquaintances and company. In mixed corrective labor camps, the CES attracted prisoners as a meeting place for men and women. But in Katorga, what reason could there be for going there? It turned out that even a CES in Katorga, full of informers though it was, could serve the cause of freedom. I learned this from Georgi Tenno, Pyotr Kishkin, and Zhenyard Nikishin. It was in the CES that I met Tenno, and that single brief meeting stayed clearly in my mind because Tenno himself was so memorable. He was a tall, slender man of athletic build. For some reason, they still hadn't stripped him of his naval tunic and breeches. Some prisoners were wearing their own clothes for one last month. And although instead of the shoulder tabs of a captain second class, he wore in various places the number SKH-520, he was every inch the naval officer, ready to step aboard at any moment. When his movements bared his arms above the wrists, you saw little reddish hairs and tattoo marks. On one arm, the word Liberty around an anchor. On the other, Do or Die in English. Tenno simply could not lower his lids or squint to hide the sharpness of his eyes and the pride in them. And another thing he could not hide was his big, bright smile. I did not yet know it, but that smile meant, my plan of escape is drawn up. That's the camp for you, a minefield. Tenno and I were both there, yet elsewhere. I was on the roads of East Prussia, he on the route of his next escape. Each of us was charged with secret thoughts, but as we shook hands and exchanged casual words, not the smallest spark could leap from palm to palm or eye to eye. We said something unimportant. I buried myself in my newspaper, and he began discussing amateur performances with Tumarenko, a political in for 15 years, but nonetheless in charge of the CES, a complicated man of many layers. I thought I knew the answer to him, but had no means of verifying it. Ridiculous as it may seem, in Katorga there was also a concert group attached to the CES, or rather in process of formation. Membership conferred none of the privileges of such groups in corrective labor camps, exempted a man from nothing, so that only incurable enthusiasts would ever want to join. Among them, it appeared, was Tenno, though from his looks you would have thought better of him. Besides, he had been in the punishment cells ever since his arrival in Ekibastutz. It was from there that he had volunteered for the CES. The authorities interpreted this as an earnest of amendment and permitted him to attend. Petya Kishkin was no CES activist, but the most famous man in the camp. All Ekibastus knew of him. Any work site was proud to have him. With Kishkin around, no one could be bored. He appeared to be crazy, and was anything but. Though he acted the fool, everybody said, he's cleverer than the lot of us. He was the same sort of fool as the simple youngest brother in a fairy tale. The Kishkins are a phenomenon of great antiquity in Russia. They loudly tell the truth to the wicked and powerful. They make the people see themselves as they are, and all this by foolery, which involves no risk to themselves. One of his favorite turns was dressing like a clown in a funny green waistcoat and collecting the dirty bowls from the tables. This in itself was a demonstration. The most popular man in the camp gathering dirty dishes so as not to die of hunger. A second reason for doing it was that while he was jigging and clowning around the tables, always the center of attention, he rubbed shoulders with the working convicts and sowed mutinous thoughts. He would suddenly snatch a bowl from the table with the mush yet untouched. The prisoner was still only sipping his broth. The startled prisoner would grab at the bowl and Kishkin would dissolve in smiles. He had a moon face but with a certain hardness in it. Till somebody touches your mush, you never grasp anything. And he dances lightly away with his mountain of dishes. Before the day is out, Kishkin's latest joke will be going the rounds in other work teams too. Another time he leans out across the table, and the rest all look up at him from their plates. rolling his eyes like a toy cat with a buffoonish look on his face, Kishkin says, "Listen, lad, if the father's a fool and the mother a whore, will the children be fed or go hungry?" Without waiting for the obvious answer, he points at the litter of fish bones on the table and says, "Divide 7 to 8 billion poods per annum by 200 million. And off he goes. It was so simple. Why had none of us thought of it before? It had been reported long ago that we were harvesting 8 billion poods of grain a year, which meant 2 kilograms of bread a day for everyone, including babes in arms. Right, we're grown men making holes in the ground the whole day long. Where's our share? Kishkin varied his material. Sometimes he would put the same thought the other way around, with a lecture on anything and everything. When the column was waiting before the guardhouse, at the camp or the worksite, and talking was allowed, he made use of the time to harangue us. One of his regular slogans was, "Educate your faces. I walk around the camp and I look at you. You all have such uneducated faces. Can't think of anything except their barley cake." Or he would suddenly, for no obvious reason, shout at a crowd of Zeks, "Dardanelle! Tommy Rot!" It seemed to make no sense, but after one or two shouts everybody clearly understood who Dardanelle was, and it seemed so apt and so funny that you almost saw the menacing moustache on his face. "Dardanelle!" One of the bosses barks at Kishkin outside the guardhouse, trying to get a rise out of him for a change. "How come you're bald-headed, Kishkin, you so-and-so? Got dry rot, have you?" Without a minute's hesitation, Kishkin answered so that all the crowd could hear, "Is that what made Vladimir Ilyich bald, then?" Or he might go around the mess hut announcing that after the dishes had been collected, he would teach the goners to do the Charleston. Suddenly, a great surprise. A film had arrived. It was shown in the evening in the same old mess hut, without a screen, on the whitewashed wall. The hut was filled to overflowing. There were people sitting on benches, on tables, between benches, on top of each other. But before it had run far, the film was stopped. A blank white beam played on the wall, and we saw that several warders had come in and were looking for the most comfortable places. They selected a bench and ordered the prisoners to vacate it. The prisoners decided to stay where they were. It was years since they'd seen a film. The warders' voices grew more threatening, and somebody said, "Right, take their numbers." That was that. They had to give way. Then suddenly a familiar mocking voice, like the screech of a cat, was heard through the darkened hall. "Now, lads, really, you know the warders can't see a film anywhere else. Let's move." They exploded in laughter. What a force is laughter. All the power belonged to the warders, but they beat an inglorious retreat without taking numbers. "Where's Kishkin?" they shouted. Not another sound out of Kishkin. Kishkin was missing. The warders went away, and the film continued. Next day, Kishkin was called before the disciplinary officer. He'd get 5 days for sure. No, he came back smiling. He had given a written explanation as follows. "During the argument between warders and prisoners about seats for the film show, I called upon the prisoners to give up their seats as they're supposed to and to move away." What had he done to be put in the hole? The prisoner's irrational passion for shows, his ability to forget himself, his grief and his humiliation for a scrap of nonsense, on film or live, insultingly showing that all's right with the world, was another subject for Kishkin's skillful satire. Before a film show or concert, would-be spectators flock together like sheep. Time goes by and still the door stays shut, while they wait for the head warder to bring his lists and admit the best work teams. They wait half an hour, slavishly pressed together, crushing each other's ribs. Kishkin, at the back of the crowd, slips off his shoes, vaults with a hand from his neighbours onto the shoulders of those in front, and passes quickly, nimbly, from shoulder to shoulder, over the whole crowd, right up to the gate of paradise. He knocks, his short body writhes from head to foot in a pantomime of impatience to enter. Then he runs back just as quickly over all those shoulders and hops down. At first the crowd just laughs, but then they feel deeply ashamed, standing here like sheep. Right, let's give it a miss. They disperse. When the warder comes with the lists, nobody is trying to break the door down. In fact, there's hardly anyone to let in. If he wants an audience, he'll have to round them up. Another time, a concert was just beginning in the spacious mess hall. They were all in their seats. Kishkin wouldn't think of boycotting a concert. There he was, in his green waistcoat, fetching and carrying chairs, helping to draw back the curtain. Each of his appearances drew applause and friendly shouts from the hall. Suddenly he runs across the front of the stage as though someone were pursuing him, and waving a warning hand, shouts, "Dardanelle! Tommy Rott!" Roars of laughter. Then there was some sort of hitch. The curtain was up, but the stage was deserted. Kishkin dashed onto the stage. The audience started laughing, but immediately fell silent. He looked now no longer comic, but insane. There was a wild glare in his eyes. He was terrifying. He declaimed a poem, trembling, gazing around unseeingly. "I look, and ah, the sight I see, the police rain blows, the blood flows free, streets littered with the dead and dying, son beside father, murdered, lying." This was for the Ukrainians, who were half of the audience. They had only lately been brought from seething provinces, and it was like salt on a fresh wound. They howled. A warder was rushing at the stage, and Kishkin. But Kishkin's tragic face relaxed in a clown's grin. He shouted in Russian this time, "When I was in fourth grade, we learned that poem for the 9th of January." And he left the stage, hobbling absurdly. Zhenya Nikishin was a nice, simple, sociable lad with an open, freckled face. There were many like him in the countryside before its destruction. Nowadays you see mainly hostile expressions there. Zhenya had a small voice and liked singing for his friends in the hut or from the stage. One day, "Wife of Mine, Little Wife" was announced. Music by Mokruzov, words by Isakovsky. Performed by Zhenya Nikishin with guitar accompaniment. A sad, simple melody trickled from the guitar, and Zhenya faced that large hall and sang to each of us, showing us how much warmth and tenderness there still was in our hearts. "Wife, O little wife, dearer far than life, you and you alone live in my heart." You and you alone, the long platitudinous slogan about output plans up above the stage, grew dim. In the blue-grey half-light of the hall, the long years of camp life, years already lived through, years still remaining, faded. You and you alone. Not the crimes we were alleged to have committed, nor our reckoning with authority, not our wolfish preoccupations. You and you alone. None could be more dear, none could be so near, whether we're together or apart. It was a song about endless waiting for news that never comes, about loneliness and despair. How appropriate it was, yet prison was never directly mentioned. It could all equally well refer to a lengthy war. Though I was an underground poet, my instinct failed me. I did not realize at the time that the verses ringing from the stage were those of another underground poet. How many of them are there? But a more flexible one than I, better equipped to reach his public. What could they do to him? Send for the music sheet? Check whether it really was Isakovsky and Mokruzov? He had probably said that he could do it from memory. In the blue-grey dimness sat or stood some 2,000 men. They were so quiet and still that they might not have been there at all. Men calloused, brutalized, turned to stone, but now touched to the heart. Tears, it appeared, could still break through, still find a way. "Wife, O little wife, dearer far than life, you and you alone live in my heart." Chapter 6. The Committed Escaper. When Georgi Pavlovich Tenno talks nowadays about past escapes, his own, those of comrades, and those of which he knows only by repute, his words of praise for the most uncompromising and persistent heroes, Ivan Vorobyov, Mikhail Kaidarov, Grigory Kudla, Havitz Havitzov, are these. There was a committed escaper. A committed escaper.